Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Gerald Nachman, whose latest book is Right Here on Our Stage Tonight, Ed Sullivan's America. Earlier books include Seriously Funny, Raised on Radio, and three books, compilations of columns. Gerald Nachman has been with several different newspapers. He was with the San Francisco Chronicle as entertainment columnist and reviewer 1979 to 1993. He's also worked on several musical reviews. And in 1979, was a member of the Pulitzer Prize Committee for Drama. But let's get first to Ed Sullivan's America, right here on our stage tonight. The book contains approximately 120 different interviews conducted over several years. Two questions. First, what prompted you to get started on Sullivan, and how many years did it actually take you to work on the book?
The book idea started out as a book about early TV, and then the publisher I thought I had at one point, which was Pantheon, which had published my other two books that you mentioned, decided that they wanted just a book about the Ed Sullivan Show. And then they lost interest, and I don't know what happened there. So I came to UC Press, and they said they loved the idea. And so it started out as a different kind of a book, a big sprawling book, which I really didn't want to do. I'd done two big survey books. I love the idea of just focusing on one show.
I noticed there were some interviews with people who were long passed away.
Yeah, and some died not long after I interviewed them, Robert Goulet and a lot of people, because a subject like this, everyone associated with it tends to be up in years.
When they came to you and said, we want Ed Sullivan, at that point, where were you in the creation of the survey book?
A little bit along. I'd worked on it for about 6 or 7 months. I talked to John Provost, the kid who played on Lassie. And I talked to Don Herbert, Mr. Wizard. People of a certain age will remember that. And I talked to several people to do with early TV, and I was kind of getting excited about it, but it was a huge, huge topic.
How much of the Sullivan material had you gotten at that point?
I hadn't really done much on Sullivan at that point. I got a little bit. You know, when you work on a book like this, it's kind of a triage. You want to get to the oldest people first, obviously. So I did talk to some people who had been associated with the show who were older, such as I talked to his son-in-law, Robert Precht, who was the second producer of the show, and Precht's wife, Ed Sullivan's daughter, who is still alive. And, you know, they're probably in their 80s, early 80s. So I did get to them right away. But I hadn't really made much progress when I got the nod from UC Press.
Well, you also spoke with Marlo Lewis. He's still alive, too?
No, not him. With his widow, Minna Beth Lewis, who was very old. I think she must have been in her 90s. And she was in a wheelchair and not really too well. She couldn't talk to me more than about 45 minutes, which I was delighted. I didn't even know she was still alive in Santa Monica. And I talked to her. And she's very sharp-witted, even in her 90s, and even very ill. She had a lot of great things to say.
The reason we mention those two is that Marlo Lewis and Robert Precht were the two producers of the Ed Sullivan Show. But
right.
Let's go back to Ed Sullivan. For people under a certain age, because Sullivan went off the air in 71, and while videos and DVDs of his material still surfaces, a lot of people don't know who Sullivan was. So let's go back to the 1930s when Ed Sullivan got his start.
He started out as a sports writer while still in high school, actually, and then he segued into Broadway gossip columnist when there was an opening. And I guess he wanted to get out of sports. He felt this would be more, you know, have a broader canvas for him. So he started as a Broadway columnist in the 30s.
And at that point, he became a rival of Walter Winchell, who now is pretty much completely forgotten.
Well, not Winchell. I don't think Winchell's been completely forgotten. There was a great biography of him that came out about 10 years ago, which was a good source for my book by Neil Gabler. Anyway, Winchell and he were professional and personal enemies. Because they had worked together on the same paper, a real sleazy tabloid called the New York Graphic, and there was some office politics, and Sullivan felt that Winchell had double-crossed him. So there was a lot of animosity between them. And the other thing was that Winchell had a hugely popular Sunday night radio show, and Ed Sullivan wanted to get into radio, and he tried 3 or 4 times, couldn't make it. He was intensely jealous of Winchell. He realized Walter Winchell was a power, and he wanted to be a power also. Ed Sullivan had a lot of ambition. He was kind of a dogged, single-minded guy.
When he started with Toast of the Town, at that particular time, television was in its infancy, and most people did not have televisions.
Right. 1948 was really the first year of television. It had been on very spotty in 1947, but in 1948, all the hours of the day were filled in up to about 10 o'clock. All the stations would sign off around 10 o'clock. But he got in on the ground floor, and that's one reason he got in, because they didn't have any TV stars, because TV hadn't existed. So they were scraping people, you know, off the bottoms of various rocks, and he was one of them that was there at the right time, you know?
It's sort of the way cable began, I guess.
I think that's a very good analogy, yeah. Any medium that starts, you know, the early movie stars, who were they? Were not very good. You look at them now, some of them. Radio stars, you know, they came out of vaudeville, as did the TV people came out of vaudeville.
The original show, it was a variety show from the beginning. Was there much variety on radio, or are we looking at the transformation of vaudeville directly into television?
Well, his show was really patterned after vaudeville. It was kind of what I call streamlined vaudeville. A vaudeville show would run 2 or 3 hours. His show ran an hour. Each act only had one singer had one song. Comedian had maybe 6-7 minutes. But the radio variety shows were really different than his show, like Bob Hope's show and many others. Even the other variety shows on TV, there were sketches, there was banter, and there was none of that on Sullivan's show. His show was really an assembly line, one act, boom, 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 after the other. No banter, except he would ask people to come over and say a few words. No sketches. It was just all one act after the other.
Well, part of the reason for that was Sullivan himself, and it's made clear on almost every page of right here on our stage tonight, which means over 400 pages. Each page delineates the same fact that Sullivan was not comfortable on television.
He was not very comfortable on television, but the interesting part about that is before he had got the TV show, he produced and hosted and emceed stage shows in New York. He started doing World War II benefits and fundraisers, and he was considered pretty suave and pretty slick on stage doing these fundraisers. But on TV, he kind of froze up, and he was really the kind of petrified, frozen-faced guy we all remember. Offstage, he wasn't much of a schmoozer either, I don't think. He was, in a way, pretty much what you saw, except he relaxed, of course, more and was known to be charming off camera. But on camera, he was this kind of wooden cigar store Indian.
And yet he became beloved down the road, though, of course, people, when making fun of him, made fun more of Will Jordan's parody of him than of Sullivan himself.
Will Jordan was the first guy to do Ed Sullivan, to do him, to imitate him. He was one of the best, still is, I think, if you look at the imitations. Sullivan was very canny in a way about the impressions of him. He was very thin-skinned all his life. He would lash back at columnists that made fun of him. And after a while, he decided to turn the joke around and, you know, embrace the joke. And he had mimics on like Will Jordan and John Biner and Jackie Mason, a lot of people, who would do impressions of Sullivan. That kind of ingrained his identity in the public mind, and he became a much warmer figure.
And also interacting with Topo Gigio the mouse, the Italian mouse, yeah, must have helped as well.
Well, yeah. He did a lot of interacting after the show was on the air for a while. He loosened up. It loosened up the show somewhat. He was still kind of stiff, but at least there was some byplay between the guests and puppets and stuff like that.
Gerald Nachman, what made Sullivan a star, a television star, for over 20 years was the ability to sense when a person was on the verge of stardom and grab them at that exact moment. But it wasn't just him alone. It was Lewis and Precht as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Marlo Lewis was the more cultured of the two. He loved opera and he loved ballet, and the show had a lot of ballet segments, excerpts, a lot of divas, a lot of opera stars. That was largely Marlo Lewis's doing. Sullivan was not really interested in opera or ballet or the classical arts, but he realized that there was an audience for it. So he very wisely put that on, along with the puppets and the dog acts and the animals and the ventriloquists.
But what made the show was the ability to find Elvis and put Elvis there, the Beatles, a number of people who were, you know, lesser known now, but at the time became superstars like Stiller and Mira.
He did not really discover people in the sense that he found people who were newcomers. There were a few, such as Senor Wences, people that nobody had ever heard of. But usually, as you say, there were people on the crest of stardom who he had seen in clubs, because he covered clubs as a gossip columnist, or they were recording artists, or they had done concerts, or they were in radio. And he gave them a national platform. That's why his show was so crucial. I mean, they all would have broken through in time, but it would have taken them a lot longer. Sullivan was a newsman, and he loved headliners. He had a nose for news. He trusted his nose for news, and Elvis was making news. Elvis had actually been on a show before Sullivan. He'd been on a summer replacement show called The Dorsey Brothers, which was a summer replacement for Jackie Gleason. And he made quite a hit on a couple of those shows. And then the Beatles were taking Europe by storm, not just England, but Europe. And he had spotters here and there, and this guy in England told him, these are the hottest four guys going. So Sullivan would very warily put them on the show. It's not because he thought they were great, but because they were making news.
Well, Nora Ephron was there at the show when I interviewed her a couple of months ago. Her comment was, I don't remember anything about it because I couldn't hear anything.
We've all seen the clips of the screaming teenage girls, and you really couldn't hear them. And in fact, there's a story in the book about the engineers. They couldn't hear the Beatles to give them the right sound levels because there was so much shrill screeching from the audience.
Well, one thing that I always noticed about Sullivan, because, I was a teenager and younger in that period, when people were on American Bandstand, it was all lip syncing. And Sullivan did not allow for lip syncing. Everything had to be live, which I think is very important.
Yeah, he hated lip syncing. He was very proud of the fact he didn't have canned laughter on either. It was all real, and he took great pride in that, as he should have. I think toward the end of the run of the Sullivan Show, they did have some people who were singing to tape. But most of the run, he believed in the purity of performance.
The other element that you take great notice of is Sullivan's politics, which people don't really talk about, his ability to counter the racism of the 50s and 60s.
He was good about that. And the reason for that is he'd been a sports writer. He mixed very easily with blacks. He was a sports fan way more, even to the end, than he was a showbiz guy. He wasn't at ease around entertainers. He was around athletes. And you recall he would have athletes on the show a lot. And again, part of his beat was going up to Harlem to see who was at the clubs, who was hot, who was making news, and he would have them on his show. He loved to present black entertainers because they hadn't been presented very much. He wasn't doing it to score social points. He just thought they were good entertainers.
But there was also a lot of negative feedback if a white performer or Sullivan even touched a black person.
Literally true. If he put his arm around Ella Fitzgerald or kissed Pearl Bailey or shook hands with Nat King Cole, he would hear from mostly the Southern affiliates. And Sullivan really did stand up to them, and he almost got in a fight with a Southern station owner who was in the booth, in the sound booth during a show and was objecting to it. He considered himself a liberal, even though he looked like a banker. He was an FDR Democrat.
But he didn't stand up to McCarthyism.
No, he caved in on McCarthyism. That's kind of a weird anomaly because he was looking out for his show and for himself. CBS was kind of virulently anti-communist, as a lot of big corporations were, especially in entertainment. And they leaned on him to not have people on who were tainted by, red channels and some of those really horrible magazines that were naming people as, communists.
His politics were liberal, and I guess that meant that he was more open to certain things, not just blacks, but also when rock and roll came in. Did we have any sense of his actual politics where he actually stood up for something?
I can't think of any. He'd grown up in a small kind of an industrial town, Port Chester, New York, just about an hour outside of Manhattan. It was a blue-collar town, and he'd grown up with all kinds of ethnic minorities, and he himself was an Irish Catholic, and they were kind of looked down upon at the time from a big Irish family. So he felt some prejudice in his day, so he was somewhat sensitive to that. And he married a Jewish woman, also another element to take into consideration.
You're listening to an interview with Gerald Nachman, whose latest book is right here on our stage tonight, Ed Sullivan's America, now out in trade paper. I think those of us today who see interracial marriage on television so often that we don't blink anymore.
Not anymore, yeah.
Who see gay people on television so much that we don't blink anymore. It's a completely different world. Were you stunned a little bit at what you discovered in finding out about prejudice during those eras?
I don't think I was stunned because I knew what was going on at the time. You know, you'd have to look at a lot of shows. And there were a few black entertainers, the big, big names. You know, Louis Armstrong, for instance, was everywhere. Maybe Ella Fitzgerald even. But some of the lesser knowns that Sullivan had on, you would never have seen. Well, Richard Pryor had a big debut on the Ed Sullivan Show before he changed his persona. He was this, looked like a college kid with a bow tie and very clean cut. He was kind of open. He wasn't that open to rock and roll. I don't think, again, it was what was happening. And he was very attuned to what was happening. You know, his idea of music was, you know, Maurice Chevalier and Sophie Tucker and really the old timers. He did love Motown, however. That's one reason I put the Supremes on with him on the cover of the book. Also because it kind of has something to do with his generosity booking black entertainers. He did love Motown because it's more show busy, you know, with all the choreography and stuff.
As an entertainment columnist for many years, when you look at Sullivan, what impact do you think Sullivan had overall on entertainment? I mean, specifically, we could talk about certain people reaching new levels because they had national exposure. But in terms of race, in terms of class, in terms of anything like that, do you think Sullivan really counted?
Well, he counted, but I don't think he had much of an influence because there were no other shows like that. And there had always been variety shows going back to radio. And I don't know if he helped loosen things up about booking blacks. He must have because his show was so big that it kind of did loosen things up a lot. And the country was gradually changing, not so much as his show. But I don't know if he had much of an impact overall. As you say, he had an impact on individual performers. As somebody said, if you were on his show, you could get a year's worth of bookings.
Sullivan of the 50s and 60s, how would you compare his importance to Carson of the 60s and 70s?
He was sort of the Carson of the 50s and 60s, actually. Carson was on in the 60s. Carson considered him a bit of a competitor, even though they were on at different times. And Jack Parr, earlier than Carson, he and Sullivan went head-to-head for guests, and they got into a big feud over how much would be paid the guests. Parr, who was on every night, five nights a week, only paid the union minimum, $320, and Sullivan paid $4,000 or $5,000. Sullivan got kind of riled. He said, why should we be paying these people all this money when they go on Jack Parr's show and they only get a certain amount of money? So he said, well, if they go on Parr's show and they just sit on the couch and talk to him, that's fine. But if they perform, I'm going to pay them the same thing. So they had this big feud, and Parr invited Sullivan on the show to discuss it. It was actually on the cover of Life magazine. It was such a big deal in those days, feud between variety and talk show guys.
And in the end, of course, Parr disappeared, and Sullivan kept going. Sullivan, there were two phases. Phase one was under Marlowe Lewis, and that was the opera stars and Broadway shows. And then when Robert Preck took over, we saw more rock bands. There's a point where you kind of talk about how, in its own way, rock and roll killed Sullivan and his show. But at the same time, there were two other things going on. First, rock and roll sustained the show because it brought in younger people. And secondly, there's a certain point where people who listened to Dean Martin didn't want to listen to Janis Joplin.
Well, that's right. It kind of turned around on him. He made a lot of news and made a big impact. Well, that's an impact by having rock. Huge impact by having rock performers after the Beatles and even before, you know, having Elvis and that whole era. But then after a while, it's a very curious thing. This is something I didn't realize until I talked to some people who know about rock more than I do, that after a while, kids who loved rock didn't want to see them on TV, and it was considered kind of declassé for a rock act to be on what kids considered a cheesy show like Ed Sullivan. You know, they much rather see him in concert. I talked to Joel Selvin, you know, the pop critic at the Chronicle, who gave me a lot of information and kind of insights into all this, and rock acts didn't want to be on the Sullivan Show after a while.
Part of it also was that when Precht came along, they began having the weird psychedelic effects and all of that junk. And in those days, you went to concerts to listen to music and watch the performers, and it got annoying. I didn't want to see that crap.
Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting, because you're younger than I am, so you remember it. Yeah. After Precht took over, Precht was almost 30, so he was of the right era. He was interested in rock. He'd grown up with rock. So he was the one that really turned the show into a different kind of a show. He would have on, as they say, cutting-edge comedians like Pryor and Carlin, even Moms Mabley.
Gerald Nachman, you make a comment, and it's very offhand. You come back to it a couple of times toward the end of the book, but it kind of hit me, because it comes in the middle of the book out of nowhere, then disappears, that there were hints of Alzheimer's as early as 1965, never diagnosed.
Those are his daughter's words. She said, I think we would call it Alzheimer's, early Alzheimer's. He was in his late 60s, early 70s. He was 72 and went off the air in 71. And he was getting very forgetful. He wouldn't know who was on the show that night. Precht was really running the show. He would have, you know, tacit approval of everybody. Toward the end, the last 1 or 2 years, it was kind of rather poignant. He once went home on a Sunday afternoon, took a nap. He forgot he was doing a show, and they had to go get him back to do the show.
He had a teleprompter, but why did he constantly blank on names?
You know, that's a very good question. He had a teleprompter. He probably didn't pay attention to it. He never, as we said earlier, he never felt comfortable on TV, and he probably couldn't keep up with the teleprompter. He probably tried to wing it part of the time. And as you know, because you read the book, there's a million gaffes, some of them very, very funny screw-ups, introductions of stars in the audience and on the show.
Gerald Nachman, you began work on this and suddenly got deep into Sullivan. Would you have liked to have known him or not?
Well, I would have liked to have known him as a phenomenon, and having done a lot of research, I would like to get an idea of what he really was like. But he was kind of unknowable in a way, you know. He didn't have a lot of close friends, and the friends he had tended to be sort of mogul types. The only entertainment person I could find in my research that he was close to was the singer Jerry Vale and his wife. They were friends of the Sullivans. Why, I don't know. I talked to Jerry Vale. He didn't have much to say. He wasn't a very introspective guy, really. He was a reactive guy. I'm a little ambivalent, to be honest. I admired him, his doggedness and his ambition and his refusal to give up. He was so vilified by the press after he broke in because they thought he was so ill-suited for TV, and he was. But as I said, also, he turned that around. He made it work. He made it happen. He stuck it out. He didn't cave in, except on the Tainted Performers. Major figures like him, there are people who are really at least two people, because he could be tyrannical and a hothead and a real nasty guy and turn around and be Mr. Charming, warm, understanding, sympathetic. He was known to be a soft touch for old vaudevillians and for old kind of broken down athletes. You know, he was a good guy in a certain way. He reminded me a little of the way Sinatra is portrayed, you know. I don't think he was as nasty as Sinatra. He was not really. He was a pretty decent guy. But he did blow up. He had a lot of feuds, and he had later apologized.
Gerald Nachman, 1979, you were a member of the Pulitzer Prize Committee for Drama. How did that work?
That invitation came out of the blue. They wanted somebody from the West, is how that happened. And I was at the San Francisco Chronicle, and someone wrote me a letter or called me or something. I can't remember. It was a long time ago. And asked if I would. I said, sure. Well, yeah, it's a huge honor. But then you have to get up to speed. A lot of the plays that are nominated are not still running when you're at the time that you're chosen. So I read a lot of plays.
Does that really give you an idea? I don't think it does.
Not really. I hate reading plays. I don't have a good enough visual sense. So the play that won was called The Kentucky Cycle. It's this big 7-hour, you know, marathon show, which I did see. I forget how it happened. Oh, it was done in L.A. I saw it there. Gordon Davidson produced it.
Is that who you voted for?
I don't remember, to be honest. I think I probably did.
Well, you were with the Chronicle for a very long time. What do you see as the future of newspapers? I mean, there's now talk about creating models that pay. The London Times, I read today, tried a paying model and lost 86% of their readership.
It's up for grabs. Nobody knows. Newspaper people, least of all, know what's going to happen. They're just clinging to the edge of the cliff, hoping that something will turn around. I'm hoping that a lot of the Internet stuff will become less of a novelty in time, and it already is in a way. You know, they say that, you know, teenagers never do email anymore, you know, the Twittering and texting and all that. So these things have a certain fad aspect. And I think if newspapers can hang on long enough that they might survive, It's the medium-sized papers that are having the most problem. Small-town papers can get advertisers because local advertisers don't advertise anywhere else. And the big newspapers can make it if they go outside their own circulation area, like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal.
But the problem is mid-range ones, the Chronicle, or the one in Seattle or wherever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's sad. It's really sad. And I worked for a couple of mighty titans, Titanic newspapers, the New York Daily News, which is still pretty big, but it's hurting. The Chronicle is hurting.
You worked on three different musical reviews, Mixed Nuts, which was Quirks, Aftershocks, and New Wrinkles. How did you get involved with those?
Well, I have a friend who writes songs, a guy named Maury Barbaro, who writes a lot of reviews. He's been writing reviews for 30 years in the city. He's a good friend, and I always wanted to write. I don't write songs, but I wanted to write sketches. So we decided to write one in 1979. It opened at a little place in San Francisco on Clement Street called the Open Theater. Maybe you remember that, kind of a little hole in the wall. And then it ran in L.A. for a while. And then we were going to take it to New York under the title Mixed Nuts, and we couldn't get it. We were going to make it into a cabaret show, and we couldn't find a cabaret that was interested. And then I did a show called Aftershocks with another friend of mine, Rita Abrams, who's written a lot of shows and a lot of songs. And that didn't last very long. And I naively put the money up for that and, lost a bundle, as everyone does. It does that. And then the last one, which is still have productions of here and there, called New Wrinkles, which is about aging. And all of us are aging who wrote it. Maury and Rita and I all worked on that. That's had half a dozen productions in the Bay Area.
Have you begun work on any others?
No, it might have cured me. We had a lot of creative wrangles, and after a while you kind of, I don't know. I would do it if the subject came along that I thought was really a wonderful subject that would be worth doing.
You're still keeping up with Broadway musicals these days?
I keep up, but I don't go very often because, the Broadway musical, as you well know, is not the same creature it was, even 10, 20 years ago. So, it's hard to find shows that I want to see that are not popsicles, as I call them, not musicals, popsicles.
Let's get back to Ed Sullivan. What do you think we can take away from a book like Right Here on Our Stage Tonight about our own era and how it relates to earlier eras?
Well, everything that was important ended up on the Ed Sullivan Show sooner or later, from the pop acts to the comedians to movie stars. He was the first to do advanced segments on upcoming movies. He would have movie stars on and chat with them on stage, kind of primitive talk shows. Remember that line, somebody would win a championship and they say, where are you going? They say, we're going to Disneyland. There was no Disneyland. Well, there was after a while, but people would not say, but their first stop was the Ed Sullivan Show. Miss America, or the guy that just won the archery championship, they all went on Ed Sullivan first. So that was the place to be seen and to launch a career from there.
Is there anything like that now? Anything?
Maybe the Tonight Show, but they don't even have, I don't think they have a lot of comedians on there anymore, people like that. There is no more showcase. I call the Ed Sullivan Show was the big window on Main Street, really, was the Ed Sullivan Show.
I think at one point Saturday Night Live had that cachet.
Saturday Night Live, but not anymore, I don't think. And American Idol is the hottest, most watched show, but that's not the same thing. Families gather to watch it, I'm told, like they did the Sullivan Show.
And Glee now is getting some of that, but Glee is scripted, and this was different.
Yeah.
Every 2 years we move into a new political realm, and now we're moving into the political realm of an extreme right-wing House of Representatives balanced by Democrats to keep them in check, and we don't know where we're going. When we go back and look at our history, one of the important areas of history is our culture. And the culture of the 50s and 60s, particularly the 50s and early 60s, was defined by Ed Sullivan. And I'm just wondering what we can take away from that.
Well, I always say it's one of my private beliefs. It's unprovable. But the cultural phenomena, like the Ed Sullivan Show, really have as much or more of an influence on us in our lives than the current Congress. I think that's transient, almost by definition. I don't think political stuff It's exciting and people yell and scream about it at the time, but I don't think it stays with you. I think cultural stuff does.
So in that sense, if you were going to look at the cultural elements of Ed Sullivan, what would you look at today as kind of the exemplar that we could look down the road and see how culture had changed?
Well, you could look at comedians because they always reflect the culture pretty vividly. You would see people on there like Alan King and the old-fashioned comedians, and then suddenly you'd be looking at Mort Saul, and then you'd be looking at Robin Williams, if he had existed then. And you would see things change that way, and you would see it in music and every other way. As the culture changed, so did the Sullivan Show, or you don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, whether the Sullivan Show really helped change the culture. I think it's back and forth. You know, a show like that always wants to reflect the culture, but it also has to lead a little bit, too. And while, as I say, he didn't discover a lot of people, he did give them a national platform. The Sullivan Show, I claim in the book somewhere, actually does as much as 500 channels because that would funnel everything into one show. It would be the best of all that stuff. Now you have to go channel by channel by channel, and you'll eventually find what you want. But it's much, you know, he was a much more efficient way of funneling that into 1 hour.
Well, we're also more fragmented now.
Yeah.
I mean, the water cooler shows like Mad Men, it's a very small water cooler.
It is, you're right. And there aren't many shows like that either. So, yeah, I think they probably did talk about the Sullivan Show the next day at work because everybody watched. There were 3 channels that you had to watch it. Everybody in the family watched. There was no more than 1 TV set. Everybody heard the same jokes. Everybody laughed at the same jokes. Everybody knew the same songs. Everybody hummed the same songs until, really, I guess Elvis and the Beatles. And then, as you say, everything got fragmented.
What's the story about your book becoming a musical?
A guy called up my agent out of the blue, a guy named Aaron Harnick, who is Sheldon Harnick's nephew. And he has a track record. He produced Frankie and Johnny and Claire de Lune and Martin Short's show Fame Becomes Me. And he did a couple of revivals, Oleana and Night Mother. He did revivals of those. So he's a real guy. And we signed a contract. I signed it. I'm waiting for his signature. And once that's done, then I'll know where they are. I don't know any more about it than that. It's been at least 6 or 7 months since they got in touch with me. And his idea, I guess, is to duplicate or replicate the Ed Sullivan Show, create a kind of Ed Sullivan Show on a Broadway stage, and weave in Ed Sullivan's personal story, which is an interesting story, I think. But who knows? He's hiring a writer. I don't know who he's hired. I don't know what their plans are. As soon as he signs the contract, I'll be able to call him and find out where they are with it.
One final question. Okay, 120 interviews. Which interviews just blew you away just by being in the room with the person listening to him talk?
Well, for this book, unlike the other books, I was not in the room. I was on the phone. I only needed a short interview. Mm-hmm. I only needed to find out what their experience had been being on the show. Well, a couple of weird things happened. Leon Bibb, you know, the black folk singer, I never did figure this out. He talked to me for about 10 minutes, and then he was one of the blacklisted guys, and he was blacklisted from the show, and he said after 10 minutes, he said, "I don't want to talk about this anymore. It's too uncomfortable." So that was a new experience. I had to sympathize with him because it probably brought his career to an end. I like Carol Burnett. She was great to talk to. She's as nice as is rumored, and I don't think anybody really blew me away in that sense because I didn't spend that much time, as I say, right, with them.
Gerald Nachman, now what are you working on?
My memoirs. I'm old enough to have a memoir project. I wrote it online for a website I write for called thecolumnist.com, and about 3 years ago, and then I went back, and I just did it because I didn't have a book publisher for the Sullivan book yet, about 3 or 4 years ago. And I went back and looked at it. I said, I think this might be interesting. So I'm going back and rewriting it, and that is my ongoing project. Whether it will ever see print, who knows?
You've been listening to an interview with Gerald Nachman, whose book, Right Here on Our Stage Tonight, Ed Sullivan's America, is now out in trade paper. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.